From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The House of Representatives' inquiry into Michigan State University and its handling of sex offender Larry Nassar.
We see what happened. We see that there were individuals that knew about Nassar but didn't report it.
We'll talk with our regular commentators about Nestle getting a new water withdrawal permit despite public opposition.
You can't make these decisions based on public opinion.
We'll hear some music from the Shanty Boys.
They're called Loggers, Lumberjacks, and Shanty Boys, and it refers to the shanties in which they lived in the lumber camps.
And we'll talk to an artisan who will tell us about the finer points of ice fishing rods.
Over towards Detroit, they like shorter rods because they sit in the shanty more.
All of that, plus a Detroit Neighborhood podcast. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality approved a permit for Nestle to increase pumping out water from 250 gallons a minute to 400 gallons a minute at one of its facilities. That approval came after overwhelming disapproval from citizens. The DEQ says it must follow the law when making permit decisions, which would seem to put the whole idea of taking public comment in the category of why bother? Let's turn to our regular Friday commentators and talk about that. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is a senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us by Skype. Vicki, the DEQ says it will monitor the increased water withdrawal to make sure there are no problems. But other than that, its hands are tied. What do you think of the approval?
Well, I don't necessarily think its hands are totally tied. Their own Department of DEQ in Michigan estimates that this area will lose 1% of its surface water every year for the next 20 years. I don't think their hands are tied. That's clearly a detrimental policy. There were over 88,000 responses to this request that were filed with the Department of DEQ. 99% of them were don't do it, and only 75 in real numbers were okay, go ahead. So if the laws are tying the hands of the DEQ, then it's time for the state of Michigan to change its laws and recognize that our water is a public resource and a treasure and needs to be protected.
Well, we'll talk about that more in a little bit. Ken, I want to get your reaction to that. And just by the way, if it can only follow the laws as it's written, what's the point of seeking comment from the public?
Well, I think what the citizens of Michigan should expect from state government is that our resources are going to be protected, in this case, our water resources. And permit decisions, whether it's on water or anything else, need to be based on the law, in this case, hydrology and science, and primarily protecting the resource. So, frankly, I agree with the DEQ that you can't make these decisions based on public opinion. I think it's important to get public opinion to know where the public's at. But permit decisions, I think everybody in the state, including those who seek permits, have to have the assurance that these decisions are going to be based on law, science, and I think protecting the resource. And that's where the legislature comes in. They need to insist that the laws are protective.
You know, I've been seeing social media just blow up over this. Something I've seen a couple of times now is the idea of charging more for water withdrawal. And then do what Alaska does with oil revenue, use it to supplement the state budget and write checks to its citizens every year. Now, water is not oil. In fact, Nestle is making a lot more money on it than oil companies make on their extraction. So here's our math. I want to show you this. At 99 cents per 16-ounce bottle of water, a barrel's worth of Nestle water is $332, while a barrel of crude is going for less than $70 right now. Now, you might say that's not fair because you're comparing a finished product with an unrefined barrel of oil. Okay, fine. Gasoline is about $2.78 a gallon right now. Bottled water at 99 cents a 16-ounce bottle, that's nearly $8 a gallon. Vicki, is water a public commodity in which the state and public should get more compensation?
Absolutely. And I think that's where we are not thinking future-minded. In 1976, Alaska amended its constitution, recognizing that there was going to be drilling of its natural resources, and started charging extraction fees and other taxes of the oil and gas companies that were coming to drill on their lands. And that money went into a trust fund called the Alaska Permanent Fund. So if you're talking about the fund where it pays its citizens and funds its budget, that's where it comes from. But there's also an awful lot of money left in there permanently to provide resources for future generations of Alaskans. In Michigan, and indeed in most of the country, we haven't recognized that clean, fresh drinking water is a very, very rare resource, and that we have to start protecting that resource and charging companies that want to use it extraction fees, finishing fees, and production fees, much like Texas charges its gas and oil producers. So there needs to be changes in Michigan's law, and I think Candace Miller, the Water Resources Commissioner, the Drain Commissioner of Macomb County, has alluded to that because she's very opposed to this action, and she has threatened a ballot proposal if necessary in order to go ahead and protect our resources and get the money necessary.
Ken, the point keeps getting made that Nestle and some of the other water bottling companies often own these water wells. That ignores the fact that groundwater doesn't really recognize your property boundaries. So if the level goes down, it goes down for everyone tapping that source. How should legislators view that use?
Well, I'm going to go back to your question about whether we ought to be taxing water withdrawal, because comparing oil extraction to water withdrawal is a lot like comparing apples and oranges, in my opinion. The political conundrum here is that bottled water withdrawals in Michigan are an infinitesimal amount of the water withdrawals that are going on in the state, whether it's by industry or agriculture or municipal governments. And the political conundrum for the legislature is that what water use withdrawal do you tax and what do you not tax? And legally, they're probably not going to be able to get away with just trying to tax bottled water withdrawals. And that's why we don't have a tax on withdrawals right now. It's that problem that there are lots of withdrawals going on, many of them far greater than what's going on with bottled water withdrawals. And if you're going to tax that one, you're going to have to tax these other ones. And you're going to tax agriculture, you're going to tax drinking water supplies from municipal government. And I think that's the real political conundrum here.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the farmers, because the Farm Bureau wants more extraction in larger amounts made easier for farmers to use for irrigation. That would also benefit the other users, such as water bottling companies. What kind of effect do you think this decision will have on that legislation?
I'm going to talk about what Ken just said for a second, and that is the water that's being extracted by Nestle's does not stay in the Great Lakes watershed. And that's one of the key differences here. And it also bypasses municipal water authorities. So they're building their own tap-in production. And I think at that point that is the end product. The end product is what they're extracting. And I think you can make a case to tax the end product, which is the bottled water, either with a bottling fee or some other way, which gets it around the agricultural uses and the energy uses. To have a per bottle bottling fee seems to make sense to me. So I think we can find a way to delineate who we're going to tax and who we're not going to tax.
But to Ken's point, they're not the biggest users of water. In fact, irrigation is the biggest user of water in Michigan, so
the irrigation water stays in the watershed.
It evaporates.
The political conundrum is not solved here by saying, well, the water that Nestle is withdrawing doesn't stay in the Great Lakes watershed. The fact of the matter is, a lot of the water withdrawals that occur in Michigan don't stay in the Great Lakes watershed. Let me give you a real life example. Michigan has a lot of potato farmers, a lot of them north of Grand Rapids, some in northern Michigan. A lot of these potato operations are corporate farms that are internationally owned. They irrigate, use Michigan water, they irrigate the potatoes. The potatoes soak up the water. That's why you irrigate. The potatoes go to an out-of-state potato processor who makes French fries, selling to McDonald's. McDonald's then sells them to their restaurants. So somebody in New York City or California or Oregon is eating French fries that were produced in part by Michigan water withdrawals. That water doesn't stay in the Great Lakes watershed. So the political problem is just not solved by saying, well, let's just tax someone who takes water and sends it out of Michigan. A lot of the water goes out of Michigan.
You could say the same for Michigan beer or the water that goes into car radiators or anything else you want to mention.
There's a big difference between oil extraction and the water withdrawals. Oil and gas are non-renewable resources. Once you take it out, it's gone. Taking water out is replenished. Now, you have to be careful. I admit you've got to make sure you're protecting the aquifer. But that's why the Natural Resources Fund was set up, because of that non-renewable aspect of oil and gas. So we take the royalties of oil and gas and we buy another non-renewable resource, land, with oil and gas taken from public lands. That's why the Natural Resource Trust Fund is so popular.
But we have to be careful when we define water as a renewable resource, because it doesn't renew equally across the globe. Look at Cape Town, look at L.A. that is running out of water, look at Phoenix and other areas of Arizona where the water is not being replenished equally. And by the DEQ's own standards, the water in Everett will not be replenished through their simulations, their own simulations, equally. They're going to lose about 1% of their surface water per year for the next 20 years. That's 20%. So even if there is replenishment, it's not going to be enough. And so we have to start looking at water differently than we look at it now as a renewable resource, because clean, fresh water is a precious commodity, and we have to start protecting it better than we do now.
Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Guys, I'm really disappointed we couldn't solve this problem right here today.
Let's talk about school funding, too. How about that one?
Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Coming up, there's a new book that looks at lumberjack songs from the Upper Midwest. We'll be right back after a short break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and North Dakota were rich hunting grounds for a young man in the early part of the 20th century. He wasn't hunting game. He was in search of lumberjack songs. Franz Rickaby documented the folk songs, the songmakers, and the singers in a 1926 book, Ballads and Songs of the Shanty Boy. The granddaughter of Franz Rickaby, Gretchen Dykstra, and folklorist James P. Leary teamed up to compile a follow-up book to reintroduce the songs and tell the story of Franz Rickaby's travels through the lumberjack camps of the Upper Midwest. That book is titled Pinery Boys, Songs and Song Catching in the Lumberjack Era. Gretchen Dykstra joins me now via Skype. Welcome.
Thank you, Lester.
As I mentioned, Franz Rickaby was your grandfather, but growing up, what did you know about him?
Well, I knew that he existed, but he died when my own father was only four. He died in 1925 at the age of 35, 6 months before his book was published. So although he wasn't a secret in my life, I didn't know much about him. But my grandmother left behind a big old brown trunk, and I began to go through it. And it piqued my interest.
So you had a lot of notes that Franz had taken. What drove Franz Rickaby to wander the lumber camps in search of songs?
Well, you know, these early song catchers, many of your listeners probably know of John Lomax. There were a handful of these early song catchers, and different things motivated them. And that was the question that I think, in fact, drove me to trace his footsteps. I was interested to know what would have taken an English professor from the University of North Dakota wandering around the Upper Midwest. I think it was a combination of Franz Rickabee was in fact a poet himself, and he loved the poetry of songs. He was a very gregarious guy, taught Shakespeare and Chaucer, so he was somebody who enjoyed sort of the story of the common people. And then he was, of all things, a golf caddy every summer in northern Michigan. And there he met a couple of old retired lumberjacks. And I think it all came together. His knowledge about this early beginning interest in collecting the songs of marginal people, and then his meeting those Michigan lumberjacks.
So you found this big trunk, you're going through that treasure, you're tracing back basically his genealogy for you. How did you and James P. Leary end up collaborating on this book?
I decided to hit the road. I decided that what really interested me was to try to see where he went and what he might have seen from 1919 to 1923 when he would take these periodic travels around the upper Midwest. And after I had begun working on that, I came across an unpublished paper that James Leary at the University of Wisconsin had published accusing Franz Rickabee of being a bit of a prig, saying that he had cleaned up the vulgarities of these lumberjack songs. So, being a somewhat protective granddaughter, I called him and we had a nice chat, and he asked me what I was going to do with my writing, and I said I didn't know. And it was to Jim Leary's credit that he said, well, you know, Wisconsin now has the rights to his original book, and James Leary is an award-winning folklorist himself. He said, let's team up and bring back Franz Rickabee's book and give it new life. And that's what we've done in Pinery Boys. So my quest to find my grandfather is there. Franz Rickabee's entire book is there. And Jim Leary puts it all in a wonderfully evocative context of folk songs at that time.
About that 1926 book, Ballads and Songs of the Shanty Boy, how much has that been your guide in your book?
Well, one of the things that made Rickabee's book, I think, notable, and it has in fact become a classic, a minor classic in the world of folklore, is that he was a beautiful writer. So his notes are very evocative of the life of the lumberjacks. So I think that I was interested not so much in the songs as I was in his journey.
We're going to listen to some of the music in a little bit, but I've got one burning question. What is a shanty boy?
Ah, shanty boys is the Midwestern term for lumberjacks.
Is that right?
Yeah, they're called loggers, lumberjacks, and shanty boys, and it refers to the shanties in which they lived in the lumber camps. And in fact, when Franz Rickabee took his first long walk all the way back to Grand Forks, through the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, down into Wisconsin, and over to Grand Forks, the only songs he found were in Allenville, Michigan, in a small lumber camp called Lamerson's. And he only found two songs and realized that the heyday of the lumber industry was shrinking. It, in fact, had begun to move to the Northwest. So he, in fact, realized that he'd have to move quickly and would need to find retired lumberjacks. So that was the strategy that he employed for the next 4 years.
Well, we're going to listen to a song called Michigan I.O. This is a 1938 field recording of Lester Wells of Traverse City singing that song.
He says, my clever fellow, how would you like to go for to spend a winter a lumbering in Michigan I.O.? Oh, so boldly I stepped up to him, these words to him did say. I'm going out there a-lumbering, depends upon the pay. If you will pay good wages, my passage to and fro, I'll go spend a winter a-lumbering in Michigan, I-O.
I understand there were several versions of that song circulating at the time. How did they differ?
Well, I think what's interesting is that there were many versions of that song for different occupations. So there were railroad songs, there were cowboy songs, and so it moved from camp to camp and from state to state, depending on the occupation. And here, Lester, I might add something because I find it interesting. There were work songs at this time, during the Industrial Revolution, of railroad workers, cowboys, people who worked in fields. They would sing to keep the rhythm of their work. Lumberjacks sang to entertain themselves. So you don't, in fact, find necessarily the same beat, but you do find the same impetus, which is to tell their stories, to tell the hardships they went through. So the ballads are often telling stories of the difficulties and the dangers of being a lumberjack, the loss of girlfriends, the death of comrades, to say nothing of the difficult life that they led in the dark and cold forests of the winter.
I was wondering if they actually sang these on the job or at the end of the day back at camp. It sounds like because they didn't have the kind of repetitive rhythm in their tools that it might be something that gathered back in the camp. Is that right?
Yeah, well, the tunes would move around, but the words would change. And Lester, you might find this interesting. The lumber camps had a problem keeping their lumberjacks. So they often would pay the most to the cook and to the best singer in the camp. They would pay them bonuses so that they would stick around, because the better the singer, the more entertaining their nights were. But the songs themselves evolved based on the place and the particular stories. So the words change, but the tunes, in fact, often remain the same.
This next song comes from Brian Miller, Minnesota Lumberjack Songs, and is based in part on the version collected by your grandfather. Let's hear a little bit of Save Your Money When You're Young.
Now once I was a shanty boy, and wasn't I the lad? I spent my money foolish, and isn't it too bad? For now I'm old and feeble, and wet out in the cold. Save your money when you're young, you'll need it when
So that song came from Arthur Millow, who was working in the Michigan woods around 1894. A little advice from a narrator who apparently had learned some hard lessons. How did your grandfather, Franz Rickaby, explain what he was doing to the people he encountered and wanted to capture their songs?
Well, I think, in fact, I'm glad you played that song, because Franz Rickaby has a great line in his book that says, if a ballad can be defined as a song which tells a story, then I might still feel prompted to call this song a ballad. Because although it doesn't tell a story, it certainly reiterates the sad state of affairs of lumberjacks spending all their money on booze and women, and then as they got older, unable to support themselves. He was a very sympathetic guy and got a kick out of the stories, but also I think was supportive and understanding of the hardship when these guys got older.
Do you think the lumberjacks understood what he was up to when he said, hey, tell me a song, or tell me about a song, or sing something for me? I mean, that seems like an odd thing to walk up to a lumberjack and say.
I'm glad you asked that. Franz Rickaby was one of the only musicians among those early song catchers. He did not record the songs. He was, in fact, himself a fiddle player and read and wrote music. He'd book himself into theaters or schools or opera houses in these small towns. He would try to get an article in the newspaper saying he was coming to town. He would give a brief lecture to the people who came about who sang these songs, why they sang them. And then he would play a couple of the songs on his fiddle and then ask people in the audience if they remembered any similar songs. And that's how he found them. Because you're absolutely right. People don't just easily say, oh, let me sing my grandfather's song to you. So he primed the pump through his own music and, of course, then spread them from town to town.
This next song, it's called The Persian's Crew. A Persian was a schooner that sank around 1868 near Presque Isle.
Well, in mystery over their fate was sealed. They did collide, some say. That is all will be revealed until the judgment day. When the angels take their stand and survey these waters blue, they'll summon forth at heaven's command the Persian's luckless crew. No mother dear was there to soothe the brow's distracted pain. No gentle wife or to caress those pale lips once again. No sister nor a lover sweet, no little ones to moan. In the deep alone they sleep, far from friends and home.
Rickaby got this song from Michael C. Dean, who was working in the woods near Manistee. Some of these songs talk about tragedy and death. How dangerous was the work of the lumberjack at that time?
Extremely dangerous, not only because of falling trees, but falling branches. But then remember, they would drag the logs to the closest riverbank, pile them up, and then when the spring came and the waters were rushing, they would in fact take those logs down to the closest mill. And that's when a lot of accidents happened. They would fall into the rushing waters, they'd get caught in log jams. So it was an extremely dangerous profession, and I might add it still is.
Gretchen, this started out as a journey to learn more about the grandfather you never knew. How well do you think you know Franz Rickaby by now?
Lester, not only do I think I know my grandfather, but I in fact now love my grandfather. I learned a great deal about him, and equally importantly, I learned a great deal about the upper Midwest and what he would have seen and how the land now in some ways reflects what the lumberjacks did. Your rich farmland is a direct outgrowth of the cutting down of the trees. But my grandfather was a lovely, adventuresome man, and I grew to love him.
The book is Pinery Boys, Songs and Song Catching in the Lumberjack Era. The authors are Franz Rickaby and Gretchen Dykstra, along with Jim Leary. Thanks for sharing this with us.
Thanks for having me, Lester.
Here at Stateside, every once in a while, we like to go out and talk to people who make the things we use. We call the segment Artisans of Michigan. This time, we make a stop in Jackson. Chris Maples has been making ice fishing rods for a couple of decades now. His company is called Frozen Puppy Custom Ice Rods. I wondered why he decided to make these short rods.
There's a big demand for it, and nobody else is really doing it anymore. I just filled a niche that somebody needed.
How'd you get started?
20 years ago, my wife ended up with breast cancer, and she was home, and I was hovering over her all the whole time. And she told me to get out of the house for a little while. So I went ice fishing with my uncle. I had a store-bought rod, and I sat there and looked and says I could do it and started off as a hobby and went from there.
I understand that there are regional differences in Michigan alone about rod and rod length. Tell me about that.
The east side of the state, I'm going to say east side from like Homer over towards Detroit, they like shorter rods because they sit in the shanty more. Guys from Homer to the west side, they all like longer rods because they don't sit in the shanty and they like to move around a lot. So that's basically it.
I was talking to a guy up in Cadillac, and he was telling me the best method is don't get stuck in one hole. Just keep moving.
You find that true?
Yeah, that's very true. You move a lot. I've had back surgery 7 years ago, so I'm not that mobile anymore. So I sit and just kind of work it out. So
he designs the rod handles, and he says he hand ties everything, and he makes the kind of rod he likes, but he's open to what his customers want.
You've got different colors of thread, you've got different colors of rod, the handles, some of them are a little different than others. What goes into those decisions?
Preference. Some people just like my friend up north, he likes the glow rod in pink thread. That's just him. and everybody's got their own specific colors, and we'll go with that. Different types of handles, everybody likes their own different type of handle. So we try to fill the niche for everybody.
I'm just wondering if you've thought about expanding or going to some more automated system or something like that just to make more money, or is it just a matter of doing that handcrafted work?
No, it's all about pride. It's all about pride big time. You have to sit there and do it by hand.
Tell me about your customer base. Who buys your rods?
Everybody and anybody. I have them in the middle bucket here in Jackson. I have them at Niles at Rusty Hook. I have them at DNR Sports Center in Kalamazoo, in Knox, Indiana. And I'm going to have some in Marquette next year. But I've sent them to New York. I've sent them to Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and all over Michigan.
Anywhere they get a little ice, it sounds like.
Everywhere.
Here's the question that has less to do about making your rods, more to do about the mentality of somebody who would go out and sit on a frozen bucket in the middle of a frozen lake on a really cold day. Why do people go ice fishing?
Actually, it's a solitude, and you're fighting against the elements, and you're waiting for that fresh fish dinner at night.
That simple.
Chris Maples with Frozen Puppy Custom Ice Rods in Jackson. He's our latest Artisan of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, a Michigan House inquiry into Michigan State University's handling of complaints about convicted sex offender Larry Nassar was completed. The information was turned over to the Attorney General's office. Some of the information was released in a letter to House Speaker Tom Leonard. Representative Kim Lasada was part of the bipartisan effort to determine if MSU failed in protecting students. She chairs the Appropriations Subcommittee on Higher Education, and she joins us now. What did you learn about Michigan State University as it dealt with complaints about Nassar?
Well, I guess the most useful thing that I learned was where the downfall was, where they dropped the ball. And that's what I wanted to learn. I wanted to know what Michigan State's policy was and what happened, why it wasn't followed.
Some of these findings were labeled alarming. So can you give us a few examples of what you found really surprising and where policy broke down?
Well, I think really it wasn't, I guess I wouldn't say it was a surprise, because it's kind of what we figured. And as the Attorney General has been working diligently and started to charge others, we see what happened. We see that there were individuals that knew about Nassar but didn't report it. So they covered things up, things that he had done. And they justified it by saying, or implying, what a great doctor he is. So that was, I guess, the most interesting part to me.
Besides the complaints and a questionable Title IX investigation, where did Michigan State University officials miss or overlook behavior by Nassar that should have been cause for concern?
I don't know if they necessarily missed it. I think that they just didn't acknowledge what he was doing. In my belief, they were more interested in protecting Michigan State than they were these students, these young women. So, and that's not to say, Michigan State as a whole. I'm just, being specific to the people that knew what was going on and didn't do anything about it.
One of the findings that the report says should have raised some eyebrows was the fact that he was doing a lot of these treatments and then not billing anybody for it, which, gives rise to what was his real motivation. What did you think of that finding?
Yeah, I think that was just another red flag. We can, look at things now and definitely, question what went on. Why weren't things reported? Why wasn't there any follow-up, follow-through? The Title IX report for 2014, Nassar then was required to do a couple things that he wasn't doing when he performed, whatever he was doing. No one followed up with him to ensure that he had someone in the room, that he used gloves. Why didn't that happen? Well, we know that his boss has many issues as well. So, that's understandable.
Do you mean former Dean Strample? Is that who you mean?
Yes, okay. Yes. So it's easy to look back now and say why this didn't happen, why that didn't happen. It's good to know Michigan State was very thorough in they gave us the information we requested in the house. We looked at it, and we saw where the issues were, the problems, the breakdown. And going forward, we're working on policy changes. I'm working on the higher ed budget, including language that strengthens the Title IX reporting. I'm adding quite a bit to ensure that this doesn't happen again.
Are you taking a sort of carrot and stick approach? I mean, you chair the Appropriations Subcommittee on Higher Ed.
Yes.
You have a fair bit of sway regarding the flow of state dollars to public universities. What are you going to ask for, and what are you going to, I hate to use the word threaten, but what's the carrot and stick?
Well, I've got to tell you that the state of Michigan does provide funding for our 15 state universities. We don't provide the funding that we once did provide. So I guess the carrot isn't as large as it used to be, but they are still getting state funds. What will happen? I can tell you one thing. There's different Title IX language in the budget, and we're asking the universities to abide by our requests. It's not a request. It's what they have to do. There are some certain things they're going to have to do, and I don't think it's going to be difficult, but if they don't follow through, they will be, the funds will not be forthcoming to them. Not all of the funds, so, yeah.
What else can the legislature do to ensure Michigan State University and other state schools don't allow another predator like Larry Nassar to sexually abuse children and young adults?
Yeah, and what we're working on, and the language I said that's going to be in my budget, it's not just for Michigan State University. It's for all of our universities. It's going to be required of all of them, and that's why we've been very methodical in what we've been doing, so that what we do is going to be long-lasting and be very beneficial in the end at protecting students.
Do you think the legislature has enough power, enough clout to make sure that the schools in the state, including Michigan State University, actually make sure that a culture, we'll call it, let's see, how can I put this? I mean, colloquially, we call it a rape culture, but a culture of allowing a good old boys network to let somebody have a pass. I mean, can you change that from the Capitol?
Yeah, we can sure try. And I do have faith that the universities will work towards that. I believe that really, I've spoken to the other universities throughout the state, and I do believe and have faith in the programs that they have been using. Michigan State didn't necessarily lack a good program. It's just we had an individual or individuals that were very smart at what they do, and they looked for any holes in the system. And where they found holes, they were able to, get away with what they did. But I do have faith, and I do know that Michigan State, it's their reputation on the line, and they've been a great school. They, their ag school is so useful and important to the state of Michigan. So I do believe that they will do what they need to do to protect their students going forward.
Representative Kim Lasada was part of the House of Representatives' bipartisan investigation of Michigan State University and what it did and failed to do about the child sexual abuser Larry Nassar. Representative, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Throughout last year, we brought you stories about one Detroit neighborhood. The idea was to spend some time in one place, talk to the neighbors, get to know them. We wanted to see if the neighborhoods were experiencing any benefit from the celebrated downtown Detroit resurgence. Well, this year, Michigan Radio is trying something new, and we're turning the microphone over to the neighbors. They will be telling the stories that matter to them using a podcast called Morningside 48224. We've got a journalist embedded in the neighborhood who's going to help the people of Morningside tell their stories. And that journalist is Imani Mixon. She's a Detroit-based writer who reports on neighborhood change and actually grew up in Morningside. And she joins me now. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sounds like fun. I love my time in Morningside. I hope you are too. So this is different than anything we've done before. How are you thinking about this podcast project?
For me, it's just really exciting. And I think anytime we approach work as an excitement as opposed to an obstacle or something that we just can't figure out, it's a little more inviting. So I've just been thinking about it as a way to provide resources and access to people who maybe aren't included in some of the broader media conversations and empowering them to tell their own story.
So you've been in Morningside for a few months now. How are you engaging the neighbors? How are you getting them encouraged to, you know, contribute to the podcast?
For sure. I'm just working on being visible. I hope people know my face and name and see me at community events, at, you know, anything that's happening. I kind of want to know about it. And I've been doing my best to just show up and be vocal and visible so that they know I am kind of, you know, working with them on their side, being a resource, and that they know about the project before it even happens so that they know how to get involved.
What's the goal of this Morningside Neighborhood podcast? I mean, who's it for and what do you hope to accomplish?
Right. So it's for Morningside. This is all about Morningside. It's for Morningside, which I think makes it that much more fun and the possibilities a little bit more limitless because the people really have the choice to make this whatever they want it to be. I think that it'll be a nice experiment in lived experiences versus sort of like third-party reporting or statistics or data that sometimes you get inundated with as a Detroit resident.
So you're a journalist, but you're not actually going to be doing the reporting. You're going to assist them in telling their stories.
Exactly, and kind of do almost a Skillshare. I'm learning just as much as they are right next to them. So it'll be more about, you know, using that natural storytelling ability that so many people have and shaping it and polishing it with audio story recordings and skills that, you know, maybe haven't been introduced to them before.
So do they have to have their own recorder? How's this work?
No, we have everything. We have audio equipment, and I'm figuring out how to teach the residents to do what they can with the equipment because I'm learning too.
What kind of response are you getting?
People are excited. A lot of people are weary of what they've seen reported about them in broader discussions. So this is a challenge. Like, okay, if you don't like what you've seen, what would you like to see? And they're kind of putting that puzzle piece together. So it's really just a matter of moving from that initial interest to action and working with them to figure out what their story will be for the time being.
Now, there's a pretty large senior citizen population in Morningside, but there are a lot of kids too. Who's getting involved in the podcast?
I've gotten people from all levels of the community. Obviously, you present it a different way to different people, but you know, I had a kid who wants to do a how to create slime, like DIY podcast. I'm like, well, that could be an episode. We can make anything news if it's happening to you right here. And then also, I think as obviously you get a little deeper into the demographic and talk to more people, you kind of scratch on those issues that are of importance to the city as a whole. So there's room for everybody. And the assignment is to just tell a story, which is a nice thing to come back to.
Now, you're not just parachuting into Morningside for the first time in my life. I understand you lived there as a youngster. So now that you're back in Morningside, what do you think? What do you see that's different?
I think Morningside is still a very special place. It's still a cherished place in a lot of people's lives. And when I was there in the early 2000s, it kind of felt like its own island. It's a very specific neighborhood. It's not like other places. But as Detroit kind of gains traction and as other neighborhoods get shine, you start to think about Morningside within the context of those changes. And instead of viewing it as a site for comparison, I see a lot of people viewing it as a site for possibility and also as a platform to ask for what they want to see in the neighborhood. So that's been really cool.
So what are the neighbors talking about? I mean, what are the issues and stories they want to talk about on the podcast?
Definitely. I've heard a lot about housing, employment, education, development, and sort of what the future holds. And I think the benefit for Morningside is that they've seen places change using ideas from other people who don't live in the neighborhood. So to have this opportunity to kind of sit back and think about what you wish to see and speak that into the environment is what this podcast is for. I met Eric DeWicke at a few community meetings. Every community meeting I attend, he's also there. And he's a lifelong Detroiter, and he's been in Morningside for 25 years. And he kind of spoke about what it's like to stick through a neighborhood that maybe has changed over time.
I guess I thought back then, and I hoped, that things would come back faster or they wouldn't sink as low as they did.
That's what I found in Morningside when I was there. A lot of people are really hopeful about this neighborhood's going to come back. How will you determine whether the Morningside podcast effort is actually successful?
That's something I think about every day. and I think that this is not any other media outlet. We can't have the same expectations or the same markers of success. So it's not about necessarily numbers or likes or shares as much as it is about the conversation that's happening in the neighborhood. So as long as this year-long experiment matters to the people who, you know, are in the neighborhood and who have gotten involved, then I'll feel like it's successful. And I think it's really important to be able to document your experience and kind of freeze it in time so you can contextualize this moment, you know, empower yourself to tell a story rooted in who you are. And I think someone who was really forward-thinking after having been in the neighborhood for such a long time, since 1989, would be Doris Grayson. And she's a 78-year-old, super quiet, super reserved, but super great person who was once active in the community and has kind of taken a bit more of a matriarchal stance at this point, but she had some really good things to say about what's to come.
I think we have bright future references coming forward. I'm expecting to see it back like it was with the homes that are left there. The neighborhood will be good.
I understand the first episode is coming out today. So tell us what we can expect to hear, where we can find it. Of course, it's for Morningside, not right. For us, but go ahead and tell us where we can hear it.
Definitely. So you can visit michiganradio.org/Morningside. And this first episode, since we were just touching down in the neighborhood and I was still getting to know people, and I'm still getting to know people, I thought it was important to tell people why I'm the one telling the story. You know, it's a matter of pride being from Detroit, being from a specific neighborhood. So I thought it was relevant to let them know, look, Morningside is linked to my family history. This is why I care about it so much. So we kind of dove into my personal family history there in Morningside. And also I spoke with residents to kind of speak back to the issues that I just got a glimpse of in the early 2000s that they lived through and that they're still living through. So yes, please listen and share and enjoy and reach out to me. I'm in the neighborhood. I'm embedded in the neighborhood. So hopefully I get to meet every Morningside resident by the time I'm done.
And if you're wondering where you can find her, you can definitely knock on the door at USNAP back because you've got a little office there, right?
Right, for sure. Ring my bell, please.
Imani Mixon is the producer and trainer of the community podcast in Detroit's Morningside neighborhood. It's part of the ongoing effort by Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. Thanks. Good luck, too.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Mike Blank. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Danny Hensel, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.